In 1930, sculptor and artist Alexander Calder sent his mother a birthday present. It was a necklace fashioned from brass wire and string and bits of broken pottery. His accompanying note said, "I've been making wire jewelry and think I'll really do something with it eventually." He did. It is the 110th anniversary of Calder's birth, and NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg takes us to an exhibition of his jewelry at the Philadelphia Museum of Art.
You've seen Calder's big stabials in public spaces all over the world, black or bright red steel, arcing like dinosaur ballerinas on impossibly tiny toes. You've seen his mobiles, floaty shapes, suspended from wires, meeting a breeze. But Calder's jewelry, well, yes.
The jewelry, it's not sort of a separate thing he did. He did it alongside everything he did. It's another aspect of his sculpture.
We don't know about Calder's jewelry, curator Elizabeth Agro says, because he made it mostly for his family and some friends. His pal, painter Joan Miró, got a ring, a hunk of yellow and blue porcelain wrapped with brass wire.
That's that kind of wire that your winter coat comes back from the dry cleaner. Seriously, that is the kind of gauge of wire that a lot of these brass pieces are made out of. I mean, it's not a beautiful wire, but somehow what he does with it is fantabulous. I mean, look at that.
Rings, necklaces, pins, earrings, bracelets, a tiara even, in brass, steel, silver, and bits of old glass or crockery.
He's not a jeweler. There are no welds holding this together. I mean, he's working on an anvil and a bench, but he's not doing what jewelers do. He's not making links of things. He's taking wire, and he's doing stuff with it that no one else really was doing with basic wire.
Hammering the thin wire on his anvil, flattening and broadening it into an eighth or quarter of an inch or less, and then squiggling it into shapes, leaves, circles, and especially spirals.
Which is very potent as a symbol, if you think about it. Fertility. The spiral is one of the oldest forms of ornament. You see it on cave drawings. I mean, it's a very ancient symbol.
So there's something eternal about
it. Absolutely.
And when you put it on a wedding ring.
Well, there you go.
He made a gold spiral wedding ring for Louisa James. They met on board a ship from Europe to New York in 1929. Louisa, a well-bred Bostonian.
And she marries this bohemian.
And became his muse for life. "Sandy has tremendous originality," she wrote her mother, "imagination and humor." Some years ago on NPR, grandson Alexander Sandy Rower remembered that humor in Calder's personality and his work.
People would burst out laughing. I mean, I was with him many times in an exhibition, and people would walk in and just laugh. And he loved that.
Alexander Calder liked poking fun, too. Here's a clip from a 1950s TV interview.
"How do you know when you're finished?"
When it's dinner time.
Back to the jewelry. Curator Elizabeth Agro says Calder began making it when he was just a little boy.
And his sister needs jewelry for her dolls. And so he fashioned some jewelry for her out of telephone wire. We can all think of a moment when we were children and the telephone guy came and was repairing. I made jewelry and we all did this. But he just kept going. That's he had the smarts to sort of say, I got something here and I'm good at this and I'm going to keep making this. And that it all started then and he just continued doing it.
He got lots of encouragement at home. Sandy Calder's mother was a painter. His father, Alexander Sterling Calder, was a prominent sculptor. He did the gorgeous Fountain of Three Rivers in Philadelphia's Logan Circle. And Sandy's grandfather, Alexander Milne Calder, made the big statue of William Penn on top of Philadelphia City Hall. There are Calders all over Philadelphia. And now, in the Art Museum, a necklace that runs slim silver circles from neck to waist.
It is as thin as, I guess, the wire you might put on if you were to use silver for braces. You know, it's that kind of wire. And he's made very beautiful ringlets of silver circles so that it looks like chainmail, something like a medieval vest that you might see. But it has a V-neck and it comes down tunic-like to your midriff. This is the most delicate of them all. And the fact that it's not one solid piece of wire making the whole thing, it's many pieces of wire creating each little circle.
Now, a circle is a circle is a circle. But in Alexander Calder's hands, this basic shape is reinvented every single time. No two circles are alike in this airy silver vest, which is why he never wanted his jewelry to be mass-produced. He liked making it one of a kind, by hand, with affection. And, curator Elizabeth Agra reminds us, making it of a piece with the preoccupations of all his art.
Space, it's about occupying space. And he just sees the body as a grounding element for this other aspect of his work. Not that the body gets in the way, the body is one part of this larger work of art when you put it on.
Calder Jewelry at the Philadelphia Museum of Art until November 2nd, then travels to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York in December, and then to the Irish Museum of Modern Art in Dublin. The Calder Foundation and the Norton Museum in West Palm Beach are the organizers, and there is not a single diamond or ruby in sight. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
And you can see the amazing wire swirls on the necklace that he made for his mom by going to NPR.org.
And now you can hear a few notes inspired by Alexander Calder. Musician and composer Frank Zappa said he loved Calder's work. In a 1990 autobiography, Zappa compared his music to a Calder mobile. In my compositions, he wrote, I employ a system of weights, balances, measured tensions, and releases. Zappa recorded the piece we're hearing now, Peaches in Regalia, in 1969. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Deborah Amos.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Let's take a moment this morning to remember an American killed on an especially deadly day in Afghanistan. The day was July 13th. That's the day that about 200 Taliban fighters breached a NATO compound in Afghanistan. 9 U.S. soldiers were killed. One of the soldiers who was killed that day was Corporal Jason Bogar from Seattle. He was 25. From member station KUOW, Ann Dornfield prepared this remembrance.
Oh, wow. Look at that one.
Jason Bogar's family is flipping through photos he sent home from his 3 tours of Iraq and Afghanistan. But most of these aren't of Jason. They're portraits of Afghan children, eyes rimmed black with kohl, stare right into yours. Women peer suspiciously through jewel-colored headscarves. A baby clutches a fistful of his mother's pleated burqa in his dimpled fist.
It's the razor wire that they put around the encampment, and then 2 women in their burqas standing there, almost like blue ghosts, you know. As he talked to my ex-wife, that he said he felt like, you know, sometimes he would see the women there and think it seemed like they were in bondage.
Michael Bogar is Jason's father. He's an interdenominational minister. He says Jason was always artistic, but he was unfocused and getting into trouble as a teenager. Jason enlisted when he was 17. He went to basic training right before September 11th. Jason discovered photography during his first tour in Baghdad in 2003. After he got home, he volunteered twice to go to Afghanistan.
There's an email here. It's the second to the last one he sent from June 1st, 2008. Let's see. I really feel this is what I'm supposed to be doing. Some of the guys call me an idealist, but I do respect and want to help the little good that's left amongst this culture.
Stephanie Bell was a sort of stepmom to Jason. She was his dad's partner for 5 years. She says Jason expanded from still photography to videography, even wearing a helmet cam on his patrols. He played them videos of what war really looks like.
One thing that sticks in my mind was his joy of showing his work, being able to create something beautiful and also say something at the same time, and explain his work and have it seen.
Stephanie says as serious as Jason was about the military and his art, he could still act like a rambunctious kid.
So he would jump up behind me and scare me, and then I mean, I would get upset when he would do that. And then, you know, you can't stay mad at him for very long. He would have me in laughter within a few seconds.
Before Jason's last deployment, Michael had been reading about what was happening in Afghanistan, how the Taliban were regaining strength in Pakistan. They talked about it in the backyard right before he left.
And I gave him a big hug and said, Jason, I don't want you to go, and started weeping. And he kind of looked at me a little bit frightened, like he would do, concerned, and he said, you okay? And I said, no, I'm not okay. I said, I'm really, really, really sad. And he smiled and he said, well, I guess that's a good thing. And gave me this beautiful smile, like, that means you love me, doesn't it, Dad? It's like, yeah. Yeah.
Michael says Jason had started to enroll in art school. He wanted to travel the world, capturing stories of the cultures he encountered on film. For NPR News, I'm Ann Dornfeld in Seattle.
I'm looking here at Corporal Bogar's photographs, including photographs of children taken overseas. You can see them at our website, npr.org.
For Kitchen Window, I'm Bonnie Wolfe. Julie O'Hara is a freelance writer and recipe developer in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and she blogs at A Mingling of Tastes. She suffers from zucchini envy and has written about it for NPR's Kitchen Window Online. She joins me today. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Bonnie.
Is zucchini envy too strong?
I don't think so. Not at all. I mean, I actually suffer a lot of envy from anyone who can grow any fresh food in their own garden, because I live in a condo and I would love to have a garden someday and more zucchini than I know what to do with.
So where do you go to get your zucchini?
Usually I have to go to my local supermarket. If I can go to a farmer's market, I prefer that, because you'll find so many great varieties of summer squash at farmer's markets.
What's your favorite of the summer squashes?
I like the patty pans because they're cute.
They are adorable.
They're the little round ones with, you know, scallops, kind of a lacy edge, and they're just cute. But most of the time I eat zucchini.
Now, why of all the overabundance of summer produce is squash the one you focus on?
I focus on squash because people complain about it so much, maybe I feel the need to champion it a little bit. And the reason they complain about it is because it's so prolific. You have a squash plant in your garden, you're going to have barrels and barrels of squash to last you all summer, and you're probably going to end up trying to give it away to friends and neighbors because it's more than you can use.
Why is it so prolific?
It just grows really easily. It's a happy plant. It's an ancient crop native to North America, and there's wild squash remains that date back to 7,000 BC, but it was domesticated in North America, and when the Native Americans migrated around North America, they took the squash with them, and it grew everywhere they planted it. It's just an easy crop to grow. It matures very quickly, so once you see the flowers on there, you're going to have a squash that's ready to pick in about a week.
Tell me about squash blossoms.
I love squash blossoms, and I didn't give any recipes for them because they're really hard to find. I rarely see them. If they're at a farmer's market, I'm thrilled, but they're hard to find unless you grow the plants yourself. And they're just the flower of the plant, and if it's a female squash blossom, it will turn into a squash, and if it's a male, it's there for pollination purposes, and you can pick the males and you can saute them in olive oil and toss them with pasta. You can stuff them with ricotta cheese. You can deep fry them. They're just delicious. They're an edible flower.
And yeah, talk about pretty.
Mm-hmm.
What are some other summer squashes that we may not be familiar with?
I love the eight ball squash. It's a great name, first of all,
yes.
Yeah, because it looks like, you know, a pool ball. Or sometimes they're called globe squash, and they're great for stuffing. And, I mean, just picture the presentation on that. You know, you can stuff it with sausage, ground meat, vegetables, top it off with cheese, and it's a great little main course. There are really pretty striated yellow squash, you know, like with yellow and green stripes. There's pale green ones that are just minty green and white. There are so many varieties, I hesitate to give names because you just, you know, go to your market and see what looks good and try it.
Saraya Mohammed, who is the producer of this podcast, was away on vacation for 9 days and came back to find giant zucchini in her garden. What should she do with them?
Oh, that is the perfect illustration of what can happen if you're not careful and vigilant about your squash, because they grow so quickly, and if they get too large, then they lose their tenderness and the soft texture, and you can either pick them off and use them, you know, sort of as compost, or, and this is probably a better option, you can grate them and use them in squash bread, muffins, or pancakes. I have a recipe for pancakes on a kitchen window, and they're also good for stuffing and roasting, because when they get large, the skin gets firm and the seeds get big, and they're not as tender and sweet as the young squash.
Well, in her defense, she did tell her house sitter to pick them when they were small, but apparently that didn't happen, so she'll be happy to hear this. One of the recipes that you use, I just loved. I had never thought of this, but it was to take a vegetable peeler and first peel the squash, but then use the vegetable peeler to make ribbons of squash to put in pasta, and I guess you could use it with other things.
Right. I love that technique, and it's great because there's no cooking involved unless you want there to be. But yeah, you just take the squash and you peel long ribbons along the length of the squash, and the texture you create is just great. It's got a little bit of toothsome crispness to it, but otherwise it's just this soft ribbon-like piece of squash, and you can toss it with pasta, you can toss it with olive oil and lemon just to make a salad, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful presentation. It would be great as a bed for grilled fish, maybe. A million things you could do with it.
Maybe Saraya can use her big squash to do that. All right, Julie, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And now, for an update on commercials.
Your world delivered.
Learn which companies to trust and which to avoid.
Maximum Strength Medicine provides fast pain relief.
Kills weeds, not your hands.
Maintains healthy cholesterol safely, naturally.
Offer applies with enrollment and Triple Advantage.
Marketers call that clutter. It's sometimes hard to sort through all that clutter and figure out which commercials viewers find persuasive. A company called NeuroFocus has a new approach to rating their effectiveness. It studies brain activity to figure out what TV audiences like. First, they hook you up to a machine that measures your brain waves. Then they turn on the TV. NPR's Kim Masters reports.
CBS still has an old-fashioned method of evaluating its programming and promotions. It gets people together in focus groups and it asks them what they think. But lately, the network has become interested in the brain.
What has happened now is the environment has gotten so much noisier that this type of research has gained a new relevance.
That's CBS executive David Poltrack explaining why the network has recently hired NeuroFocus. NeuroFocus does its work inside a nondescript building on a street corner in Berkeley, California. I decided to let the company test drive my brain. Robert Knight is a professor of neuroscience at Berkeley and the NeuroFocus consultant.
What we're going to do now, you're having this cap put on, and we're going to record with each one of those little sensors electrical activity being generated from underlying brain cells.
Neurophysiologist Kate Reynolds fits a perforated cap on my head. Luckily, it's a shade of maroon that's a good color for me.
And then I put a little bit of gel, it's like a leave-in conditioner. It's actually pretty nice. I put a little bit in each of the holes, yep. And I'm just going to snap some sensors in. They just go on, like, buttons. They don't actually touch you.
Okay.
Go right onto the cap.
I'm not scared. Not very.
Reynolds also puts on sensors to track my eye movements.
Okay, so you can go ahead and stand up slowly. And there's that room back over there. Just go straight ahead.
I sit in the dark watching a commercial for a television show on the Discovery Channel. I've been told to keep my face relaxed as I watch nature scenes flash across the screen. A.K. Pradeep is the founder of NeuroFocus, and he gives our producer the color commentary.
In real time, as she's watching the video, her brain signals are taken, analyzed, cleaned up, processed, and these metrics are extracted from the brain waves.
The results are supposed to show three things: whether I'm paying attention, whether I'm emotionally engaged, and whether I'm likely to remember what I'm seeing. Apparently, my brain is hard at work.
Well, you can see there's a lot of attention the video is commanding. She's also getting emotionally engaged, and there are some things that she's pulling into memory also.
After I'm unhooked, Pradeep shows me a palette of scenes from the ad.
What is highlighted in red, right, are the scenes that you found particularly interesting. The zebra thing showed up, the little monkeys showed up, then the penguins walking showed up.
It doesn't seem surprising that I was engaged by penguins and monkeys, but Pradeep says the neurofocus studies are far more useful to advertisers, television networks, and film studios than tools like focus groups or polls. In those settings, he says, test subjects may not answer questions with candor because they censor themselves.
You have your parents, your teachers, your pastor or your rabbi, and everybody standing around you telling you, you can't be saying this, you shouldn't be saying it this way, and you can't be rating 5, it's proper to rate it only a 3.
He also argues that typical television network tests can be misleading. For example, audience members are often given a dial to turn up when they like something and down when they don't. But Pradeep says it's hard to remain focused on a scene while simultaneously figuring out whether to turn a knob and how far. The bottom line, according to Pradeep?
This evolving field of neuroscience, young as it may be, offers a level of clarity and certainty far beyond anything that's offered today.
It's that sort of claim that doesn't sit right with UCLA neuroscience professor Russell Poldrack. He has no association with Neurofocus or its competitors. He's impressed that some leading experts consult with Neurofocus. But he doesn't think the science supports the idea that the Neurofocus tests provide better insight than traditional focus groups. He reads from the Neurofocus website.
Pure, instantaneous, unfiltered responses offer more accurate and reliable insights than other consumer research methodologies. I think that's the kind of claim that science doesn't necessarily exist for, at least published science.
Poldrack says brain studies can show whether a person is paying attention and whether that person is engaged. They can suggest that a person is likely to remember something, though he notes that most research has studied whether information is remembered for an hour or a day. That might not be long enough to affect your next trip to the supermarket. But CBS executive David Poltrack says Neurofocus might provide fresh insight. For example, CBS has studied promotions for its own shows and found that audiences were tuning out critical information.
We've told people that there's a great new exciting program coming on, but they forget immediately when and where, at what time and on what day.
So CBS hopes brain science will help it tweak its ads so people will remember those key points. And Poltrack says it can be useful in other ways. Sometimes audiences don't say they have a strong reaction to a scene. The brain studies reveal that they do. But the brain data don't reveal whether audience members love or hate what they've seen. For that, the network must still rely on the traditional approach of asking them how they feel. Brain science is still in its infancy, Poltrack says, and
its value is limited compared to what it potentially could be.
Does that potential include implanting suggestions that would drive people to buy a particular brand? Neurofocus consultant Robert Knight says he would never engage in mind control.
Now, with that said, are we going to try to make a advertising agency produce a clearer, crisper ad? If you want to call that mind control, then we're into mind control. But in terms of making you pick something you don't want, for a reason you don't understand, I would never want to go there.
And even if he did, the science is nowhere near that kind of understanding of the brain, at least not yet. Kim Masters, NPR News.
China's path to Olympic glory is littered with a human toll. Athletes who fail to make their sport's top ranks. The country now has tens of thousands of retired athletes whose single-minded dedication to their sport never prepared them for life after the competition was over. In the second story in our Olympic series, NPR's Louisa Lim profiles one of those athletes.
Zhao Yonghua is only 31 years old, but her lifestyle is that of someone much, much older. As her mother talks, she's lying in bed in their bare room in Tonghua town in northeastern China, covered by a quilt despite the summer sunshine. She has an IV in her arm, and she's too tired to speak. This is how she spent much of the last 10 years. It's hard to believe this bedridden invalid was once a national skiing champion.
My life then was just training. We trained at dawn, in the morning, in the afternoon, even in the evening. We didn't really do any schoolwork.
Her mother, Sun Fu Yo, rifles through faded photos, showing a beaming young girl in ski gear. She was just 13 years old when she left home to join the army team, her mother says. That was once seen as a preferable path to athletic glory, because of the honor of being a soldier and the material benefits. In 1997, she won 4 gold medals at the national championships. Then she got sick. Initially, the army coaches said she just had a cold. She ended up in hospital with serious diabetes. Her mother remembers what happened next.
When she left the hospital, I asked the army if I could take her home to convalesce because her diabetes was so serious. But they said she had to go for winter training with the army team in northeastern China. When I left, she saw me off at the station and we both cried.
Despite her perilous health, Zhao won a gold medal and a bronze a year later. But the training took its toll, and soon after she was forced to retire from skiing. When I ask her if her illness is a result of her training, she doesn't stop to think.
Of course they're related, because when you have diabetes, you're easily tired, and training is extremely intense. Every day you're exhausted.
At that time, most athletes were assigned jobs or given compensation when they retired from sport. Zhao was given around $1,000 but never found a job, despite repeated pleas. Eventually, she ran out of money to treat her diabetes properly. This brought complications. Her sight began to fail, and last year she was on the brink of blindness. Her mother describes her mood.
Zhao bought a bottle of pesticide and wanted to commit suicide. I persuaded her not to, telling her, heaven never seals off all the paths. You are so young. So we decided to sell one of her gold medals.
The sale for around $3,000 was organized by Ji Ting, heard here in her office at the Olympic Star Security Fund in Beijing. She set up this charity with the Chinese Red Cross specifically to help athletes in trouble. No one knows how many there are, but the China Sport Daily estimated 80% of the country's retired 300,000 athletes end up jobless, injured, or in poverty. It's become such an issue that last year the government set aside $4 million to provide welfare and vocational training for professional sports people. But Ji Ting fears many might still miss out.
There might be some difficulties in implementation. Because there's such a huge group of Chinese athletes, I don't think it can cover every one of them.
Another victim of China's sports system works for the fund now. 27-year-old former marathon runner Ai Dongmei, whose feet were crippled by years of overtraining. Speaking in a low voice, she says things are good now. She had tried to sue her coach for inhumane treatment, but ended up settling out of court. She had also suffered poverty, reduced to selling popcorn to make ends meet. But she tells me she's married with a 2-year-old daughter. That remains an impossible dream for ex-skier Zhao Yonghua, whose mother is brutally frank about her prospects.
She has such a serious illness, no one would want her. Other girls have boyfriends, get married, bear children. My daughter just lies in bed all day.
At the foot of Zhao Yonghua's bed, the elderly television blares. It's pretty much her only entertainment. Weakened from overtraining, she failed as a sports star. But China's sports system also failed her. Cushioning her from everyday life, it used her and spat her out, leaving her with little formal education, no useful skills, and isolated from wider society. I sacrificed my health and my youth, she admits. In fact, like so many thousands of China's discarded athletes, her future too has been sacrificed on the altar of national pride. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Shanghai.
And tomorrow, we'll hear how China plans to capture more gold medals than any other country this year.
Now from unscrupulous lenders to home finance that follows religious principles. Islamic finance firms in the U.S. work with customers to help them buy homes without compromising Islamic values. As NPR's Jamie Terabay reports, the firm's conservative approach to finance has kept them and their customers clear of the subprime drama.
Khaled Akbal's brand new condo sits in one corner of a quiet leafy square in a Northern Virginia suburb. He's 62, and it's the first home he's bought in the U.S. since moving here from Canada. Some of his neighbors are under foreclosure, but that's not happening to Akbal because he didn't take out a high-risk loan.
I've always bought everything, all the big things on Islamic financing, or make sure, my wife makes sure I pay all my bills on time so that there's no interest involved in it and everything.
Here's how it works. Islam forbids charging interest in the belief it exploits people. But making money off actual goods is okay. So Akbal worked with an Islamic finance company to buy the $300,000 condo he shares with his wife. He put up 30 grand, they put in the rest. And instead of paying a mortgage, Akbal will pay rent until eventually he buys the company out of its share. The company charges a fee for Akbal's exclusive use of the house, but considers that profit, not interest. It'll end up costing practically the same as a mortgage, but the methodology is what's different.
You have essentially the same type of product.
Hossam Qutb is from Guidance Financial, one of these Islamic finance firms. He uses the analogy of a potato chip fried in pig fat and one fried in something more acceptable to people who don't eat pork.
It's a potato chip. The difference is the method by which they produce this product. The cost of those two potato chips potentially could be the same on the shelf at the grocery store.
Some of the Islamic financial groups have been around in the U.S. since the beginning of this decade. Qutb says his company initially focused on the most devout Muslims. Now his group closes on average 100 contracts a month. But they're very careful about who they do business with. Potential buyers need to give more up front, have a good credit score and savings.
If that customer cannot qualify for a home, then that person should wait. And we do turn away, you know, a number of folks because of that. We've always been, like I said, very conservative in our criteria for qualification.
Qutb says business is up 13% in the first half of this year. The Islamic finance industry itself is rather small, between $2 and $3 billion a year. That's a drop in the bucket, says mortgage finance expert Guy Sakala. He says the market for alternatives to traditional lenders is growing.
The traditional mortgage market, as we know it, is on its knees. So a lot of individuals who want to buy a home now or whatever are going to have to look to some of these more locally based lending sources.
In Khaled Akbal's Virginia condo, 2-year-old granddaughter Asya is ready for a nap. And Akbal says he sleeps easily too, knowing he hasn't violated the principles of his faith to buy his home.
As far as I'm concerned, I'm very happy that I took this step in the way that I did it. And I sleep well.
Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.